I'll talk about where we've got so far briefly, and then I want to, for the first time in these lectures, explain how it is in fact possible to do what we would normally recognize as analysis, even though we've got anti-commuting variables in the game, namely these differential forms. I hope to have enough time at the end to just talk a little bit about where this type of program might go once we abandon these hierarchical lattices, which are a big simplification, and try to go out into the jungle of real lattices. Simple cubic lattice. So, what I did up until now is more or less on this slide and the next one. We have a function g of t normalized so that g of 0 is 1, and this function defines some parameters, beta, lambda, and r, through this little formula here, because you can make a Taylor series expansion of g of t around t equals 0, and then the first the gradient term in the Taylor series expansion will give you the beta, and the next one will give you the lambda, and the r is the is something to do with the remainder because of this statement that r of t is order of t cubed as t goes to 0. Now, then we have this special type of lattice called a hierarchical lattice, but this is a definition that would work for any type of lattice, simple cubic lattice too. We just raise g to the power of a set x by saying that for each site in the subset capital X, we evaluate g at this variable tau sub x, and tau sub x was the local time . So it's the time spent at x by the random walk, x sub t. So this then becomes a random variable, this g to the power of x. And then we have a special type of map, the renormalization group map, that takes you from these three parameters into three new parameters, beta prime, lambda prime, and r prime. By this commutative, no, it's not a commutative diagram. There's no way you can go through two ways, is there? Okay, but it sounds good, right. Beta, lambda, and r is mapped to g by this little formula here. Then we raise g to the power of, g sub 1 is an L ball, a ball of radius L in the lattice. Then we convolve with this with a Gaussian measure, which I've already constructed, and then we do this rescaling, which collapses the ball down to a point. And miraculously, after you've gone through all of this, the function you get is still a function of the local time of the hierarchical random walk. And as such, you can reverse, so it's still a function of, it's a single function of tau, and as such, you can reverse this map and get back to some new parameters, beta prime, lambda prime, and r prime. And then we have a dynamical system where we just iterate this map over and over again, creating new ones. What good does it do us to have such a map? Well, the Green's function for the interacting, for the self-interacting walk, so now we introduce, we use this g to the function of big lambda. Lambda is a big finite set inside the hierarchical lattice. And so it's a complicated function of local time, which describes some self-interaction of the walk. The Green's function for the self-interacting walk, starting at A and going to B, that's B minus A there, is given by this Gaussian integral. Mu is the Gaussian part. It has this form. And tau, under the Gaussian integral, is no longer local time, but given by this differential form here. And that's the tau isomorphism I described in the first colloquium. And then what I've been describing since then is that this type of integral can be written in terms of our dynamical system this way. You can apply this map, the renormalization group map, over and over again, and evaluate this integral in a different way by using the dynamical system instead. So that was just a brief discussion of where we've got to so far. Now, how can we control this dynamical system? So first, you notice there were various forms embedded in those functions that I was looking at on the previous slide. So here's some notation. D phi raised to a multi-index alpha is the product over all sites in the lattice, and then there's a variable phi sub x at each lattice site, and so there's a differential form d phi sub x at each lattice site, and there's also a conjugate differential form d phi bar at each lattice site, and the alphas which I'm raising here to the power of are either 0 or 1. So if it's 0, then you don't put that differential form in the product, and if it's 1, then you do. That's just a convention. I'm adopting that because it fits in well with what comes next. Any smooth form on these variables phi sub x can be expanded out into its forms of various degrees, and it can be written in this expansion that looks a little bit like a Taylor expansion. 1 over these multi. So this 1 over alpha factorial there does nothing. It's 1, because every alpha is either 0 or 1, and 0 factorial is 1, and alpha 1 factorial is 1. So it does nothing, but it's just there to make it look cute, because there are other places where you'd get a real factorial later. F, which this thing that looks like a derivative of F at alpha, is simply the name for the coefficient in this expansion. And here is the form. But then, in the next line, I'm going to introduce another multi-index, beta, which is a real derivative. It's a partial differential with respect to this phi, or phi bar. So it has the same type of structure. Beta is also a beta x, the beta conjugate x, and this one tells you how many times you differentiated x with respect to phi, and this time tells you how many times you differentiate with respect to the conjugate of phi at x. Now, then we can define a norm on any differential form. You take a differential form f, you have this expansion for it here, and we can define this rather grisly-looking norm here. What is it? Just forget about this W for the moment. I need it for the theorems, but I just want to leave it all out of the notation. But there is, in fact, a weighted L-infinity norm here. You see the supremum over phi, and there's some weight which is a Gaussian weight, which has to be carefully adjusted at certain points, but I'll leave it out of the notation most of the time. So think of this as an L-infinity norm of a derivative of f. And the finiteness of this norm is basically imposing Cauchy bounds. It's saying that f is an analytic function of phi. It's saying that f is an analytic function of phi in a strip. There are many phis, but so it's a polystrip. And the width of the strip is h. Because the only way that that series can converge is if the alpha derivative of f grows as alpha factorial over h to the alpha, or beta factorial over h to the beta. So that's the norm on the forms, and that type of norm, along with another one, will control everything. We need to know two things. We need to know a uniform bound in the whole strip, which is the information encoded in this with the supremum over phi, and the other thing I want to know is just the size of the derivatives when phi is equal to 0. Need both of those things. So that's this thing with single lines on it here. You might think that that's Yes, I was wondering if someone would notice that. You're awake. Good. Indeed it is. The difference will be that I'll use this with one value of h, and I'll use that with h equals 1. You need both of those pieces of information to control what's going on, though. Now, for the one with the L infinity part in it, I'm going to choose h to be, what was lambda? Well, the initial interaction at a site is of this form, where lambda is small and positive. And if you choose h to be of order lambda to the minus 1/4, so up to a constant equal to lambda to the minus 1/4, then this norm that I've just introduced is uniformly bounded in lambda, because you see, if you look at the formula for it, here's the formula for the norm, you can scale phi by phi over h, and then all the h's drop out, and in this it's the same as taking the norm when h is 1 and no lambda in there for this function. So then you just have to convince yourself that this function has the right analyticity properties of being bounded in the right way in a strip, and then you know that this norm is finite. So that demonstrates that this norm at least understands well the initial interaction. The initial interaction will change in strange ways as we go through this dynamical system, but this norm will control it. Now, to state my theorem, I want to make these two little definitions here. So, this piece of chalk is really short. Ah, great.
That was a color.
That was a color, yeah. Anyway. So, the g of tau at this form . So, the renormalization group takes many products of this, takes a product of this, then convolves it, and then rescales. This is the map g goes into. This is a, you take a function g, you construct a new function of g by this map here. So, if we know that g has this form, then we can see, we want to write the result in the form g prime, which is again of this form, e to the minus beta prime tau, e to the minus lambda prime tau squared plus r prime. We want to rewrite it that way. I'm leaving out the betas just for a moment, and there's an explanation for why, a very brief explanation on the slide here. But just leave it out, and then you will see that the new r, which I want to construct here, is going to be obtained by this formula here. This is the renormalization group map, and this is the part of the g that I have here, leaving that out. So solving for r, I find that the new r, that there's a remainder term, is mapped to a new remainder term given by this formula. Now, that's very non-explicit, because we don't know much about the previous r, except when we're at the very beginning, when r is 0. So, instead, hoping that this r is always small, consider this object instead, where you just leave it out. Then call that the main part, for a moment, of the new r. Now this thing here comes with a covariance, which I was usually calling gamma, but it gets changed in it's convenient to allow it to flap around in various ways in the course of these estimates and generalize it. So just assume that there's a collection of covariances that satisfy uniform bounds that could appear in different places in the whole construction, and then I'll state an estimate for any of these covariances here. In fact, for later, I'll even remark that it could be a complex covariance. We'll see why we need that later. Now, the R that I'm constructing here has to obey various properties. It has to be order TQ. That's an assumption on all of the R's. And the lambda prime is constructed in such a way that this R prime is going to be order lambda cubed. It's not obvious you can achieve that, but later I'll explain why you can do that for the experts, but it is possible to achieve that. So these two conditions here are conditions that come along from that formula there and easy to verify. If we take the norm of R to be either one of these two norms that I was mentioning, see this H is 1 now in this, then here's this proposition, and the reason why it's got this name here is because my student, when I was explaining this to Gianluca, he said, what is the name of this lemma? He always wants to know the name of every lemma, as if everything is very official, you know, is in a book somewhere. And I said, well, it doesn't have a name. And so he started calling it the lemma with no name. And since that reminded me of all my favorite spaghetti westerns, that's what it's now called. So here it is. Anyway, if you take a hierarchical lattice constructed with parameter L, which is large, then you can get a constant with the property that if the main part of the error is small, then the true error is small. And this is, so at the very beginning, that's certainly true because the true error is zero, and so you can achieve this at the beginning, and this is a statement that holds for all iterates through, as you go through the renormalization group, it holds for all iterates until the main part of the remainder starts to get out of control when it exceeds this bound. And if you read the paper that I'm writing at the moment with John Imbrie, this is work with John Imbrie, you probably won't see the proposition exactly stated that way, because instead what we did was to actually exactly work out what this norm is and use that as our statement instead. But the thing to realize about the main part is that it's an explicit function of lambda and lambda prime, so you can easily estimate that, and you can verify whether this statement that the main part of the remainder is small or not. You show that it's of order lambda cubed, and if lambda is small enough, it's small enough, and then you can go one more step in the iteration, and then you check it again, you can go one more step. So this is a key lemma, because it really tells us that so long as the parameter lambda itself is small enough, the remainder is order lambda cubed. So we have this dynamical system, lambda j after lambda j plus 1, beta j after beta j plus 1, rj mapped to rj plus 1. This is the part of the whole thing that's not very explicit. There are explicit formulas for this map here, gotten from second order perturbation theory. We can just look at those explicit formulas, and if the lambda which we generate using those explicit formulas is small, then this remains of order lambda cubed. I'm going to actually show you roughly how that's proved in a second, but here are some comments for the experts. There are some really special features of the hierarchical model that make life much easier than you would otherwise get in simple cubic lattices. And one of them, which is not very important but is nice, is that this second order diagram in perturbation theory, which you'll encounter when you're trying to construct the right lambda prime and other things, actually vanishes. So there's no tau cubed part. Usually e to the minus lambda tau squared under the renormalization group will map to e to the minus lambda prime tau squared, and there'll be a tau cubed correction. That just happens to vanish in the hierarchical model. Because of this property, the covariance of the hierarchical model is a sum of scalings of a single function, and that single function has this property that its integral is zero. Here's a remark about, I've steadfastly left out the phi A and the phi B in all the calculations I'm showing you up till now, but if you want to put them in, then you do so by adding them as an additional term in here. And then you track the derivative at gamma equals zero, which means that there's a lot more work than I'm showing you, but it's not very different from the work I'm showing you. I already pointed out that when site A and site B are in different blocks of the lattice, then the renormalization group simply replaces phi A by a scaling of it. So you only have to worry about how to track this derivative with respect to gamma actually when they've scaled together on the multiple applications of the renormalization group and they've come together. Then another thing, in the previous theorems, previous talks, I've been telling you that we have to be able to work with beta with values in a very big sector in a complex plane. And I'd just like to explain briefly part of the reason why that's possible. So there's an analytic continuation which you can make, and there are two ways of viewing it. You can view it by, you can see that there's an analytic continuation either by looking at the Gaussian integral, which is what I'm talking about here, and or you can actually look at this formula for the Green's function without ever knowing about the tau isomorphism. So for the probabilists, the Green's function is the sum over all geometrical walks. Omega by a geometrical walk, I just mean forget about the times which the walk has various times which it spends at various places on its way to B. But forget about the times and just look at this object as a sequence of nearest neighbors, like that. Sum over all such geometrical objects that connect A to B. But then you put the times back in because if you condition, once you've specified this omega, that's like conditioning on, that's the same as conditioning on the number of times the walk visits various sites. And n sub x is the number of times it visits the various sites. And then you can write down the explicitly known distribution of the local time conditioned on that. And the introduction of the interaction is results in the appearance of this lambda t squared here. If you didn't have an interaction, then this would be a formula for the free Green's function, which is not too hard to derive, and it generalizes simply. Now, the point is, this is an integral from 0 to infinity here. I should write that in. Okay, where's my pen? So you can rotate the contour in the t-plane. Instead of going like that, you can rotate by 2 theta. I'm using 2 theta because it corresponds to rotating the variables phi by theta. And that's the same when you've tracked it. Well, you can see it from this formula here. It's the same as changing, it actually changes, this is the coordination number of the lattice, but it's the same as rotating the t is the same as changing the beta by a rotation. So if you have a beta if you want to analytically continue to a beta that's in a strange part of the world like this, here's the beta plane. Being a, the Green's function being a Laplace transform, you're guaranteed analyticity in some half plane. But if you want to reach a, if you want to analytically continue to a point like that, then you can do a little rotation here to bring it back into this part that you understand. The only thing you mustn't do is you mustn't rotate it so much that the lambda, which becomes complex under this, starts to get the wrong sign. Otherwise the integral will not converge. So this additional analyticity is the reason for this extended sector. It means that the theorem on the Green's function describes the Green's function in a region that looks like this. Now, I haven't fully explained what goes on down here, though. Now, I want to prove that theorem about the estimate. So, just make a little preparation here by talking about these norms for a moment. Right, so the idea, I'm going to come back to the proof of this proposition, and I just need to talk about that norm that I introduced. In fact, you don't really have to know what the norm is, so long as it obeys these kinds of properties to make this proof work. One of the properties that it obeys is that it commutes with this raising to the power. The norm of a product is this, is less than or equal to the product of the norms. That's not too surprising, because this norm describes a function that has analyticity properties, and if you multiply two functions, they still have those analyticity properties. Rescaling. If you take a form and you rescale it, then you greatly improve its analyticity properties. It's now analytic in a strip of width LH instead of H. That's because the rescaling involves changing phi into phi over L. So if it was analytic in a strip, it's now analytic in a much bigger strip. This is a typical Cauchy bound. It says that the derivative of F is controlled by this norm, but you'll need a slightly larger strip of analyticity. H prime is bigger than H, and the bigger the strip, the more you expand the strip, the better you can control that derivative, H prime minus H. Then another important property is that this norm controls convolution. Convolution has good properties in this norm. And what it's really saying, what this formula here is saying, is that convolution is almost like the identity. If you have a function that's controlled by one of these norms, then convolution acting on it does almost nothing. You can understand that in the following way. Convolution by a Gaussian is the same as applying e to the Laplacian. And e to the Laplacian is the identity plus the Laplacian plus, of course, mu convolved. Well, you can write it this way. Something like that. And this is of the form mu convolved with the Laplacian. So if I put in a function here or a form, this remainder term has the form of some convolution times a Laplacian of F. So the estimate above shows you that applying a Laplacian to one of these functions, which is analytic in a very big strip, is a nice thing to do, because it releases this very large factor if H prime is much bigger than H. So these are functions with the property that if you differentiate them, they get much, much smaller. So the error terms, this term and this term, in this type of in comparing convolution of f with just the identity acting on f, the error terms are down by a factor of h to the minus 2. There's one factor of h for each derivative in the Laplacian. And finally, the remainder, having the property that its order t cubed as t goes to 0, gives you the following thing. If you take this remainder and multiply it by a function that prevents t from ever being very large, this e to the minus lambda t squared prevents t from ever being very far from the origin, because it's small, then the norm in a, if you use analyticity in strip H, width in a strip of width H, and compare it with analyticity in a strip of much larger width, you can get a factor of L to the minus 6 out. So if I change the width of analyticity by a factor of L, then a function which has the property that it looks like T cubed scales down like L squared cubed, L to the 6th, with its norm. So this is nothing more than the following thing. If you have a function f of t, whose Taylor series looks like t cubed plus other things, if you scale it down by L squared, you'll get a factor of L to the minus 6 out. It's basically saying that. Okay, so now I want to give a rough idea of how to prove this proposition. So it'll do it inductively. We start by assuming that the interaction, the remainder in the interaction R is smaller than twice the main part of the remainder. And then the exact remainder, R prime, one step later, is given by a formula where I've left out some terms, which I'll explain in a moment. So what I did here was take this formula here, and the renormalization group map acting on it has this form. Let's raise it to, I'm using x for this ball of size L. Convolve and rescale. Now, take this formula here and expand it. When you expand this product here, there's a term with no R's. Then there's a term with one R. And then there are terms with two or more R's. Now we get the exact remainder, R prime, by taking this and subtracting away from it e to the minus lambda tau squared, lambda prime tau squared. Now this is what we call our main. That's the main part of the remainder, the new main part. So that explains why there's a new R main on this side. The terms with one R, that's not an R prime, but R to the power of 1. The terms with one R are exactly what I've written out here, except I've left out the convolution. I've only put the scaling in there. The reason for leaving out the convolution, remember, is that we have an estimate that says that convolution is almost the same as the identity. The error that you make in replacing convolution by the identity is this thing, h to the minus 2r. And the error that you make by not writing down all of these terms with two or more r's is this thing, order r squared. So I've written out the most important two terms right there. Now let's look what happens. Scaling, what it does is it collapses a ball down to a single site. And if you collapse it down to a single site, then you only have one local time at this new single site. So it's basically you make this tau constant on every site. You take all these different taus, there's one for every site in the L ball, and you make them all equal to the same one, which means that this sum has nothing more to do. It's counting the same term over and over again. So instead of writing that sum there, I put how many terms there are in the sum, L to the 4. This is exact on the hierarchical model, the statement I just made. This is a great simplification of the hierarchical model. That's how rescaling works. So you get a factor of L to the 4. Then I estimate this term here in the norm, in the H norm, and I get the thing that's not obvious about estimating it is why this thing raised to this power has simplified down to e to the minus lambda tau squared. And that's, of course, the magic of four dimensions, that lambda is dimensionally invariant. So it works like this. If you take e to the minus lambda tau squared and you raise it to the power of L to the 4, which is how many points there are in a ball of size L, and at the same time you replace phi by phi over L, which means that tau becomes tau over L squared, then it comes back to being e to the minus lambda tau squared. So that's why this thing to this power here is just e to the minus lambda. Now, actually, it's slightly less. It's e to the lambda tau squared. There's one, because one site was occupied by an r instead of an e to the minus lambda tau squared. So it's, this number here should be slightly less by a factor of L to the fourth minus 1 over L to the fourth. But don't worry about that. The rescaling collapses all of these things into e to the minus lambda tau squared, and then it does whatever it's going to do to S of r. Next thing. Use that estimate that says that R is of order T cubed. So you expand the size of the width of analyticity, and you pick up a factor of L to the minus 6, which cancels most of the L to the 4th and leaves you an L to the minus 2. Finally, use the fact that scaling in a big, a scaled object in a big strip is the same as the norm in a standard strip. This is how we get back to the norm we started with. And you see that the exact remainder is equal to its main part plus a factor of L to the minus 2 times this thing. We apply the inductive estimate to this thing, and we get that the exact remainder is less than the main part plus a factor of L to the minus 2 times twice the main part. Now, this main part is from the previous step rather than that, but they are almost the same. This place is where I'm fudging a little bit in the proof. You have to argue that they are actually almost the same. And remembering that this is an explicit function of lambda, that's the same as showing that lambda hasn't changed very much. We know that lambda changes by this second order. By second order perturbation theory, we know that lambda changes by this rule. So it doesn't change very much. And so this factor of L to the minus 2 is way enough to control the difference between r and r prime here. So you see that the new remainder is less than the main part of the new remainder plus something which you can squeeze into a, just take L large enough and you've got two of them. Now, what's happened here? Something ugly. Excuse me a second. Okay. So that was the main lemma that controls the exact remainder by something explicitly calculatable. Now, in the remaining 3 minutes or so, I want to talk about what would happen if you wanted to do some of this for the simple cubic lattice, or instead of a hierarchical one. Now, nothing has been done on the simple cubic lattice by this procedure yet, so I'm only speculating at this point as to what's possible, but something has been done along the lines that I want to talk about for field theories on R4 by many people. I'm just talking about one particular procedure here, which is in this paper, and some work in progress with Pronod-Mitter right now, which the purpose of what I'm saying now is to just show you that the hierarchical model is awfully close to being the total truth, even on the simple cubic lattice, at least for field theory. The difference is I'm leaving out all these forms. So Joel has some huge homework exercise now, which is to put these differential forms back in, because he's the expert on dealing with anti-commuting variables. I only know what I would do if there were no differential forms at this point. So here's how it would work. Let's think about working in the continuum. If you want to work on a lattice, that's going to lead to the same basic issues as working in the continuum, because as you rescale, the lattice gets finer and finer and finer. It starts to look more and more like the continuum. And to work in the continuum right from the very start is a simplification, but not too morally incorrect, I think. So then if I write g to the lambda, what I really mean is a product over unit boxes paving R4. And these are functions of fields in the unit box, so they are measurable. A G delta is measurable with respect to sigma algebra generated by fields in the box. Now, then you can expand a product like this by the binomial theorem, which doesn't have any combinatoric coefficient here because I'm summing over sets rather than integers here. You select those where... I don't want to tell you what G twiddle is, but it doesn't matter. Just you have some other function, and you subtract and add it, and then you can expand it out that way. Now, suppose that you choose these functions in the following way. One, G depends on two random variables, phi plus theta, whereas G twiddle only depends on one random variable, and I want to integrate out an increment or take a conditional expectation. You can think of it either way. So integrating out an increment is the same as convolving with this Gaussian measure, because I'm considering doing this type of an integral. And basically what I'm doing is I'm integrating over zeta with respect to some Gaussian measure, and I have expanded this thing out into this form as g lambda take away set x evaluated at phi as g x theta sum over x, and the point is that since this doesn't depend on phi, I can move it right in there and take the integral there. So that's mu c is my notation for just integrating over the increment zeta in this function here. Now, what I'm describing here is a combinatorial cluster expansion. It's better than a normal cluster expansion because it demands that you know far less about the properties of a function than a normal cluster expansion will. For those of you who know what cluster expansions are, that is, and don't worry if you don't, because I'm explaining it now. Now, I make the assumption that this increment that I'm integrating out here has a covariance C, which is finite range. So two points separated by more than the distance capital L have zero covariance, which means that they are independent, because these are Gaussian measures, and Gaussian variables are independent if their covariance vanishes. Now, that means that this convolution, this integral over the increments that I've put there, can actually be factored past some of this product. You can take this x, suppose x looked like this. You could have had a unit ball here and another unit ball over here, which are separated by more than L. If you have that, then you can factor the mu past that product. That's what I'm doing there. I've divided x into its components, and I've put the integral over mu past them. Now, when you've done this, you started with a function of a very simple type. It was a product over unit boxes of functions, but now you've got something much more complicated. It actually has this form. It's a sum over all possible partitions of the whole big universe, lambda, into subsets, and then there are these functions that are tied to subsets. Because you see, if, for example, you had two of these boxes next door to each other like that, you would not be able to declare them as independent. So instead of having a division of your original world into unit boxes, you've got your original world divided into unit boxes and unions of unit boxes which are connected. It's more complicated. This is called a polymer expansion, this thing here. Now, suppose we started with a polymer expansion. Instead of this simple thing, we started with one of these, but the polymer expansion had this form. Whenever X was a unit box, it was our interaction plus a remainder, just like in the hierarchical case. And whenever X is bigger than a unit box, it's some really complicated function that we don't understand too well, but it's small in norm, in the same sort of norm as I was talking about. Well, you see, notice that it's very similar to the hierarchical case. The hierarchical case is simply when this term is zero for every x that's bigger than one. That is the hierarchical case. So what one has to prove, which you don't want to stay around for long enough, well, it's not that hard to do, is that if you apply the renormalization group map, which is a convolution followed by a rescaling, to one of those polymer formulas that I had before, it stays in that polymer formula, so that sum over partitions, product over X in the partition of G sub X, is just mapped by T to a thing of the same type with new polymer, these are called polymer activities, with new polymer activities. So in that sense, it's very like the case we've already had. The polymer activities have this form, e to the minus lambda tau squared integrated over X plus a remainder if X is a single unit box, and otherwise something which we don't track so well but we know is small. That's the difference. And then in this paper which I mentioned with Dimmock and Hurd, although I didn't express it this way, there's an estimate that looks this way. It says that the remainder minus something explicit. Now you remember that I told you that various diagrams vanished in the hierarchical model, but they don't vanish in this case, so you need something explicitly subtract away from the remainder that's calculated by second order perturbation theory. The true remainder is bounded by the main part of the remainder minus this quadratic part, and this estimate stays in force for as long as you can control the main part of the remainder. So that's what we know how to do already on R4 with various models, and one would hope to try to do that in the case where we have these differential forms as well. And I will just finish by another even harder problem than what I've just mentioned, which I think would be really exciting. It's known already in constructive field theory in some cases how to deal with strong coupling where lambda is large. Now if you could do that, if you could do that, if we could take those methods from constructive field theory and apply them to this model with the differential forms, then you would have a huge extension of Donsker-Varadon theory, and you would also be able to get a very detailed description of what's called the collapsed phase of walks. But that is a really hard problem, because to do that you first have to understand what Balaban has done, and that's already a big undertaking, as Joel probably knows, because I think he's had a go at it. Thank you. It does, yes. And actually, John Imrie and a student had a go at it, but they never had any output from it, unfortunately, although things seemed to be going quite well until the student got a job working for a computer company instead. So, no, I would think that the hierarchical thing is a natural thing to try first, just to get warmed up on this. Yeah.
Didn't they write a paper on it?
Did they write a paper on it, or did it, I don't know, did it ever get published?
I don't know, I saw a preprint.
There's a preprint, I think, but I'm not sure that I know that it ever got published. Yeah. But in any case, they did some work, and it was working well, and they even announced some results, and then I'm afraid I don't know what happened after that. I should know, but I don't. They were considering the case of lambda, of tau squared. One would want more general functions as well, I think, to really do this well.
Well, thank you very much, David, for the entire series.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's very nice.